Today is Wednesday, June 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A UN court upholds the conviction and life sentence for the man known as the Butcher of Bosnia.
In 2017, former Bosnian Serb military chief Radko Mladic was convicted of genocide for the Srebrenica massacre.
Plus, a new report documents the failures leading to the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol building.
The report lays out breakdowns within several intelligence agencies and the Capitol Police.
We'll have these stories and more next. Bosnian military chief Radko Mladic's genocide conviction, as well as his life sentence, were upheld Tuesday by the United Nations International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals. Known as the Butcher of Bosnia, Mladic had appealed his convictions for war crimes and crimes against humanity during the 1990s Bosnian War, including the 1995 Srebrenica massacre. Lisa Bryant starts us off.
The appeals chamber, pursuant to Article 23 of the statute.
The ruling read out by the UN Tribunal in The Hague closes at least one chapter on the 1992-95 Bosnian War, including one of its most horrific incidents, the Srebrenica massacre, which killed about 8,000 men and boys in an enclave supposedly under UN protection. It was Europe's worst act of bloodshed since World War II, part of a broader Bosnian Serb campaign to drive out Muslims. Overall, the war killed 100,000 people and displaced another 2.2 million. In 2017, former Bosnian Serb military chief Radko Mladic was convicted of genocide for the Srebrenica massacre, a conviction upheld during the ruling Tuesday, along with Mladic's life sentence. He was also found guilty of ethnic cleansing against Muslims and Bosnians. Now in his late 70s and wearing a black suit and blue tie, Mladic looked grim as the ruling was read out, occasionally shaking his head.
Finding that Mr. Mladic is not guilty of genocide under count one of the indictment.
The appeals verdict was delivered by the UN's International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals, the body dealing with cases from the now-closed Yugoslavia War Crimes Tribunal. The judges also rejected the prosecution's appeal of Mladic's earlier acquittal on wider genocide charges. This latest ruling is final. Mladic was captured in 2011 after years on the run. Two other key leaders also faced trial at the War Crimes Tribunal, former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic and former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. Karadzic is serving a life sentence for the Srebrenica genocide. Milosevic died in jail in 2006 before his trial was over. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
On Monday, Eritrea's foreign minister sent a letter to the United Nations Security Council criticizing previous decades-long support by U.S. administrations for the Tigray People's Liberation Movement. The Associated Press reports that Osman Saleh's letter accused President Joe Biden's administration of stoking further conflict and destabilization through interference and intimidation in the region. Ethiopian and Eritrean forces have been battling the TPLF since November. The violence has resulted in the deaths that are estimated in the thousands, and all sides in the conflict face accusations of committing atrocities. VOA Middle East correspondent, as well as its bureau chief in Istanbul, Heather Murdoch, is in Tigray and shared with VOA Horn of Africa service reporter Haptamu Sayom what she's seeing on the ground.
Heather, can you share us in short about your recent visit to Aider Hospital, one of the health facilities in Tigray that treats some of the rape victims?
Yes, yesterday and today we spent time at the Aider Hospital after returning from through the countryside, and where we met there the head of administration, and he told us a little bit about what they were suffering as a whole, which is fairly devastating, not just for the hospital workers, but for all of the patients. Being without electricity for so long has destroyed a lot of their equipment. Now they have electricity, but they can't replace a lot of the things that they need for caring for their patients. Among the patients we spoke to in the past 2 days were mostly women who have been victims of rape. And this is a widespread problem here in Tigray right now. They told us that in the past 7 months of this war, there's been more than 500 rape victims coming to them. And previously, in that amount of time, there would be more like 200. They also said, and when I say they, I mean the social workers and the head of social work at the hospital. She said that the nature of the victims coming to them, the survivors, as they say, is quite different because normally when girls and women come for this kind of services, they come the next day after they are attacked. But now, because of war, roads closing, fear of stigma, fear of being killed by the rapist, women and girls are waiting months sometimes to come for help. And what ends up happening is often girls come too late for the kind of treatments they want. We talked to several of the women and girls who were victims, and their stories were harrowing and oddly similar in that each one told us a story, a different story of a time where soldiers came to their house and raped them. In some cases, it was more than two people. And in some cases, the victim, one girl we talked to, was only 16 years old. Another girl we talked to was in college, and she was questioned by the soldiers who demanded she join their military at 22 years old, and she refused. And they took her in the house and they raped her. And the most tragic part about this story is for every girl or woman that they find in Mekelle, the capital of this region, they say there's probably 20 others that have not come forward or are not able to come forward to get help.
Heather, earlier you have mentioned that the soldiers asked some of the victims to join them. Which soldiers are we talking about?
Both. I mean, of the victims that we have personally spoken to, they have reported seeing Eritrean soldiers and Ethiopian soldiers. And we ask them how, of course, they know who is who, and they can identify uniforms and language.
You have been in Tigray for the last couple of days. How do you describe the situation of the towns you visited and the people you talked to so far? Is there any progress or the resentment is still there?
The conflict here is definitely still going on. The fighting itself may be mostly far away, but it's still very prevalent. Even in Mekelle, appears to be calm, but, you know, we see soldiers coming in at night into the hospital, and hospital workers say that they have emergency cases of soldiers from fighting every day, and children with war wounds packing the hospital. And then outside of the city, it is, like, for example, we went to a town called Housen that has changed hands maybe four or five times since this war began. We went there the other day, and they had been, it was controlled by the Ethiopian Federal Forces at the time for 2 weeks. The city is things we saw in Iraq and Syria, and the infrastructure, a lot of that is destroyed. The people are quite nervous because at the time, and now, war can break out there at any moment. They've had essentially four or five wars in the past 7 months in that small town. Most of the people have fled, and we've met many of them displaced here in Mekelle and in other places. But in the town, there are a lot of people who stay there saying they don't have the capacity to move out. And outside the town, most sadly, is there are mass graves scattered all around the town. We visited one with 25 people, a couple of others with one with two people in it. And this was a result of battles being fought, with most of the civilians fleeing. And when civilians came back, they found bodies of civilians on the street, and they buried them themselves and are hoping in that they will get the ability to, and authorities will help them, rebury these bodies in a churchyard. But so far, they remain in shallow graves scattered around the town.
Heather Murdoch is VOA's Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief. She was speaking to VOA Horn of Africa service reporter Abtamu Sayom from Mekelle, Tigray. Burkina Faso's prime minister on Monday visited the village where at least 132 people were killed and another 40 were wounded over the weekend. in what has been called the worst militant attack in recent years. Reuters' Gloria So has this update.
Prime Minister Christophe Joseph Marie Dabire spoke with survivors at a nearby hospital on Monday and visited Solon himself. There he condemned the rise of, quote, terrorist extremist groups.
La sécurité, c'est la...
Security is the government's responsibility. It's the responsibility of security and defense forces, but it's also the responsibility of the entire population. People need to commit to working with us so recruitment of our young people by extremist groups stops.
No group has claimed responsibility for the raid yet. The country declared a 72-hour national mourning period in the wake of the attack. Attacks linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have been on the rise in West Africa this year. That's despite the presence of thousands of UN peacekeepers. The Sahel region, including Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, has been hit hardest by the violence. In just over 2 years, more than 1 million people have been displaced in Burkina Faso, where some 20,000 refugees from neighboring Mali also reside.
Gloria So of Reuters. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A little more than 5 months after the January 6th U.S. Capitol riot, a Senate report is describing sweeping failures around the attack. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the details.
The report lays out breakdowns within several intelligence agencies and the Capitol Police, a series of missteps that allowed rioters to violently force their way inside. It's the first bipartisan review of the insurrection and maybe the last. It comes 2 weeks after Senate Republicans blocked a bipartisan commission to investigate the insurrection. The report does not even call it an insurrection, nor looks at its root causes, including then President Trump's call for supporters to fight like hell. The Senate Homeland Security Committee's chair says the report will allow for some immediate security improvements, but acknowledges it does not answer some bigger questions. Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden embarks on his first overseas trip Wednesday. It'll take him to the Group of Seven meeting in Britain, a NATO summit, a gathering of European leaders in Belgium, and then talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Switzerland. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says Biden, with his decades of experience in the Senate and 8 years as vice president, is well prepared for the trip.
He's been getting ready for 50 years. He has been on the world stage. He's known a number of these leaders for decades, including President Putin and including a number of the leaders he'll see at NATO and he'll see at the G7.
Administration officials say the trip will demonstrate U.S. leadership in helping the world recover from the coronavirus pandemic. It will also help repair relations with some countries that frayed during the 4 years of the presidency of Donald Trump and his America First agenda. Environmentalists for decades have had mixed feelings about nuclear power. Now U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has decided to cautiously embrace the energy source, despite lingering safety concerns, to help achieve its goal of a net zero carbon economy for America by the year 2050. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has that story.
This nuclear power plant, with a pair of decades-old pressurized water reactors, produces about 20% of the state of Virginia's electricity. The nearly 100 nuclear reactors across the United States will be absolutely essential for the country to meet the goals President Joe Biden has set for greenhouse gas emissions, according to his climate advisor, Gina McCarthy.
Now, I don't expect those old ones to be around a long time, but I do expect them to be safe, and I expect them to continue in a way that's going to allow us to keep the greenhouse gas emissions down with really stable baseload capacity.
Aside from reliability, nuclear power production is relatively compact. The equivalent of a 1 gigawatt reactor would require numerous solar panels or wind turbines, blanketing an area several hundred times bigger than what is needed for a typical nuclear power plant. Dan Stoddard is Dominion Energy's chief nuclear officer.
There's not a sufficient recognition of nuclear as being carbon free. So I think that's in part on us as an industry to better communicate that fact. We have a great story to tell in nuclear.
For decades, environmental groups warned about the risks of nuclear power, pointing to accidents at Three Mile Island in the United States, Chernobyl in Ukraine, and Fukushima in Japan. They also raised concerns about where and how to safely store radioactive waste for the long term. Greenpeace, once on the forefront of this, no longer actively campaigns against nuclear power in the United States. The group declined VOA's request for an on-camera interview on the topic, but it did send a statement arguing nuclear energy is both expensive and dangerous, and just because nuclear pollution is invisible doesn't mean it's clean. The group suggests that instead of pouring money into new nukes, the Biden administration should focus on phasing out fossil fuels and investing in the transition to a renewable energy economy. The nuclear industry calls that outdated thinking.
These plants, approaching 50 years of operation, have never operated more safely or more reliably in their history. The United States nuclear industry has an incredible track record of safe and reliable operation.
Nuclear plants like this one remain the country's top source of emissions-free power generation, but they were not designed to last forever, and very few new ones are being built in the United States. Decommissioning too many of them could send Biden's clean energy goals up in smoke. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the North Anna Power Station in Mineral, Virginia.
Tests have started around the United States as well as the world of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine in children aged 5 through 11. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The tests are being done in 26 states, including Louisiana. Adam Bright's son in New Orleans is getting the shot.
Like everybody, they're ready for COVID to go away as best they can. And me and my wife both feel like the vaccines are the right way to go.
Families won't know for 6 months whether their children were actually vaccinated. At that point, if they didn't get the vaccine, the children will have the chance to get the shot.
And there's been minimal side effects from my understanding, so I was very prepared to have them participate.
7-year-old Russell Bright wants the vaccine to work.
I've been trying to do all this stuff so I can see my friends.
Children 12 to 15 can now get the Pfizer vaccine. I'm Ed Donahue.
Mongolia goes to the polls on Wednesday to choose its sixth democratically elected president. Reuters' Libby Hogan has those details.
This will be the first vote since constitutional amendments stripped the office of some of its powers and limited holders to a single 6-year term. The move was made to keep incumbent businessman and former wrestler Colt Ma Batulga of the opposition Democratic Party from seeking re-election. The ruling Mongolian People's Party, or MPP, is on the cusp of consolidating its power. Ukna Kulsuk, who was forced to resign as prime minister after protests this year, is the favourite to take over the presidency for the MPP, which already controls parliament and government.
Each year we spend around $1.5 billion American dollars on buying petrol from outside our country. If this money stays in Mongolia, the US dollar exchange rate will drop tremendously. The Tugra currency value will strengthen. We will not need to worry about petrol prices.
Meanwhile, the Democratic Party has pushed a campaign with the slogan, Mongolia without dictatorship. They are fielding Sudnam Sundu Erdener and say if it loses, Mongolia will become a one-party state.
Today, dictatorship has become a reality in Mongolia. One-party rule, one-party dictatorship has become reality. Social and political dictatorship has taken root in Mongolia. Today, if you're not a member of the Mongolian People's Party, if you are not affiliated with the ruling party, it is no longer possible to do business as you choose, study what you choose, and live in the way you choose.
Both major parties have accused each other of undermining Mongolia's 30-year-old democracy.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. The U.S. military estimates that it has completed more than half of its withdrawal from Afghanistan, a pace that appears far ahead of the September 11th deadline set by President Joe Biden in April. The U.S. Central Command says it has removed the equivalent of approximately 500 C-17 plane loads of material from Afghanistan, and it has turned over more than 13,000 pieces of equipment to the Defense Logistics Agency to dispose of, estimating that it has surpassed the halfway mark of the drawdown. The withdrawal of the U.S.-led NATO force has sparked fears that Afghanistan's civil war could intensify and spiral out of control. Pakistan has formally conveyed to the United States that Islamabad will not provide military bases to Washington for counterterrorism operations in Afghanistan after all international troops exit the war-torn country, and according to a senior Pakistani official, the U.S. side has stopped raising the issue. Both sides have released few details of their high-level interactions, raising speculation about the nature of the talks and the fate of future bilateral ties. Some media reports have even asserted that Washington and Islamabad are on the verge of reaching a deal on military base-related cooperation. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan stressed that Pakistan was not the only country the Biden administration was engaging with on that subject. U.S. officials have also discussed having bases in one of the Central Asian countries bordering Afghanistan, but Russia already has voiced opposition, saying those nations have assured Moscow that they have no plans to allow such activities on their soil. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Law enforcement officials in Australia say worldwide raids against organized criminal gangs have resulted in hundreds of arrests after a three-year inquiry using an app designed by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation. The U.S. agency and Europol, the European Union's law enforcement body, presented their findings on Tuesday. Phil Mercer is up next.
Suspected members of drug trafficking gangs have been arrested in 18 countries across Asia, North and South America, Europe and the Middle East. Australia was one of the first jurisdictions to reveal the sting, codenamed Operation Ironside, on Tuesday. Police there said they disrupted drug running operations and prevented mass shootings, including a plot to attack a cafe with a machine gun. More than 200 people have been detained in raids across the country by 4,000 police officers. Large amounts of drugs, cash and some weapons were seized in an investigative operation named Operation Ironside. Australian Federal Police Commissioner Rhys Kershaw.
We allege they are members of outlaw motorcycle gangs, Australian mafia, Asian crime syndicates and serious and organised crime groups. We allege they have been trafficking illicit drugs into Australia at an industrial scale. Sadly, criminal gangs are targeting Australia because it is one of the most profitable countries in the world to sell drugs.
Since 2018, authorities in Australia, New Zealand and the United States have used an encrypted app known as Anom to track organised crime. The technology was designed by the FBI. Undercover agents distributed devices with the application to criminals, who then passed it on to their underworld associates. It allowed investigators to read millions of messages that described alleged murder plots, mass drug import plans, and other schemes. 35 people were detained in New Zealand. Australian authorities say their crime-busting raids were the nation's largest police operation. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says it's been a real success.
Operation Ironside has now charged hundreds of alleged offenders, seized millions of dollars in criminal proceeds, removed weapons from our streets and saved lives, and will continue to. It is an ongoing operation.
Australian investigators say that while the raids were successful, they were just the beginning and that efforts to combat criminal gangs would continue. They did caution, however, that while individuals and syndicates involved in alleged crime had been apprehended, there would always be someone else wanting to replace them in the illicit drug trade. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As it marks World Ocean Day, the World Meteorological Organization warns the continued rise of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is threatening the ecosystems of the world's oceans. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Carbon dioxide, the primary greenhouse gas emitted from human activities, is the key driver of global warming. Scientists say CO2 emissions hang around in the atmosphere for a very long time, from 300 to 1,000 years. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says because of this long lifetime, rising emissions of CO2 will have a profound impact on future generations.
We're not just talking about one or two, we're talking about many generations will be committed to seeing more impacts of climate change. So that means rising temperatures, more extreme weather, melting ice, rising sea level, and all the associated impacts.
The ocean absorbs around 23% of the annual atmospheric emissions of carbon dioxide and acts as a buffer against climate change. Latest data from the Atmospheric Monitoring Station in Hawaii, the Mauna Loa Observatory, find a considerable rise in CO2 emissions in May compared to those in previous years. Nullis says this is causing ocean acidification, a phenomenon that will have a very serious impact on ocean ecosystems.
This has obviously a very damaging effect on marine ecosystem systems, coral reefs. The ocean also absorbs 90% of the excess heat from human activities, and as a result, ocean heat is at a record level, and large parts of the ocean are seeing heat waves every year.
A recent report by two UN agencies notes at least 25% of the world's live coral has been lost in the last three decades due to ocean acidification and marine heat waves. If the trend continues, the agencies warn it could lead to the loss of functional coral reef ecosystems around most of the world by mid-century. That has huge consequences as coral reefs provide essential habitat for 25% of all marine life, estimated at well over 1 million species. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And finally, the ocean data that scientists need to understand climate change, marine life, and plate tectonics can be expensive and risky to gather. Matt Dibble looks at a company that uses seafaring drones in place of research ships.
This new vessel plying the waters of San Francisco Bay has no crew on board and is powered only by the wind and sun. It's being prepared for an important mission. Richard Jenkins is the CEO of Saildrone, a company that makes autonomous boats.
The oceans cover 70% of the world's surface, but they're really virtually unexplored. Less than 7% of the deep ocean has been mapped, and that's what the Saildrone Surveyor is really designed to do. What it gives us is a three-dimensional, beautifully detailed picture of every topographical feature down there.
Saildrone also has a fleet of smaller autonomous vessels that have successfully sailed the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and circumnavigated Antarctica. They are packed with sensors to collect data related to weather, climate science, and marine life. Saildrone sells the data to government, scientific, and commercial organizations.
It's really important to measure the oceans and to understand exactly what's going on so we can help not only predict the future, but possibly help change the future.
Surveyor also has sensors, but its main mission is to map the deep ocean floor using sonar.
Traditionally, research or mapping has been done by ships, very large ships like you see behind me, with a crew of 40 to 50 people on board, burning thousands of liters of diesel fuel per day. By harnessing the wind power, we can survey for months on end without coming back to port. I mean, it really removes the risk of putting humans in remote, dangerous places.
The vessels are given a destination, but work out the details of navigation themselves using onboard artificial intelligence.
For a thing to survive in the open ocean for 12 months by itself and set itself back really is a very, very tough challenge.
Saildrone vessels are proving they can survive these missions and collect data vital to understanding our watery planet. Matt Dibble for VOA News, Alameda, California.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day you can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.